conversation on Champion Love during the two previous sessions. Oh, our microphone is good.
So the purpose is to collect ideas and questions from the audience, from all of you, on the two topics, remember sharing, collaborative economy first, and social media and consumer empowerment second. And my mandate is pretty simple, because Bob told me to prepare some provocative questions only if the audience is quite shy and doesn't dare to intervene on this topic, so you understand you have nothing to do. But just before the two questions, I would like to give a couple of minutes to Les Jacobs. Les Jacobs is professor in York University and worked on that topic for many years. He published, I Googled him this morning, and he published his book on these questions, and I would like to mention the popular one, Privacy Rights in the Global Digital Economy, which is not far from the discussion we have a few seconds ago. So please, Les, if you want to use 2, 3, 4 minutes on that point.
Let me just give you a very, frankly, I do large empirical studies on access to justice, or at least right now I'm doing three of the biggest ones in Canada recently. And I frame them in a way that's relevant to this group. What I call it is meaningful access to justice or civil justice, by which I mean that it's problem-centered and it's client-centered, as opposed to how traditionally access to justice is framed. Normally in legal circles, access to justice is framed as access to lawyers. Mine is a problem-centered model. For people here at McGill, Rob Donald is a significant colleague. The idea is that when you begin to talk about problems, a lot of legal problems never get anywhere near the formal justice system. And so when you're beginning to study formal legal problems through this lens, a lot of the action is outside the formal justice system. Consumer problems are the model of that. And you saw earlier Matt and David threw up one of the big study that Trevor Farrell and I did about legal problems in everyday life, and that just sort of extends that point. And they didn't throw up one of the more interesting statistics. Even though you had about 49% of Canadians reporting a legal problem in the last 3 years, only 7% of them had any interaction with the formal justice system. Right? So it kind of gets at this idea. From the point of view of thinking about the research as well, the point is it's about justice, not law. Right? It's about how people resolve their problems rather than their per se how they. And from a policy perspective, a lot of the emphasis is about being upstream, think about legal problems when they're still legal challenges, before they morph into problems that you try to be proactive, preventative, and again, a lot of bite for thinking about consumer issues. And that's, that was the example. For example, privacy by design is a good model of that way of thinking. Just to give you a very, this whole framework gets you to rethink what it means to do research on access to justice. For example, Lauren Foster and I are doing the big racial profiling study in Ottawa, where we've been tracking for the last 2 years every traffic stop done by the Ottawa Police Service. We now have 122,000 traffic stops. We got them to change their software to collect data for us and so on. And that was a community, it came out of a human rights settlement, but it was a community-based in the sense that we did a huge amount of consumer community consultation about how you construct race, what races should be built into the study, what other things people were interested. But for this community, these racialized communities, it's clear that they see the data collection as itself an access to justice issue, which is, you know, again, not the way in which it's normally framed if you frame it as access to lawyers, right? It's a different kind of way of framing. The study that I'm doing a big study on legal information and how it helps people solve their problems. And it's a longitudinal study that began 4 months ago. And we're tracking people. We're basically identifying people at the beginning for 2 years and tracking them. So we try to get them early with they've got problems. What do they do and how does legal information deal with them? Again, most of you know that very few people have lawyers for any of their legal problems. Even family law, which is arguably in civil justice the most funded, 70% of Ontarians, for example, are self-represented for most of their interactions. And they're people who actually are pretty close to the formal justice system. Lots of other people with consumer problems, so on, don't get anywhere near lawyers. They try to solve these problems themselves, and they rely heavily on legal information. And there's been a huge push from a policy circle to try to improve legal information, see all the internet stuff, all that kind of stuff, but you know, wide range of in every province there is some kind of legal information, legal clinics, so on and so forth. But in fact, there's no research, not just in Canada, but anywhere, that actually shows whether legal information helps, right? Bizarrely, right? It's sort of one of these taken for granted that it actually helps people. But you know, intuitively, and in the research design, there are a lot of questions that seem obvious that nobody's really explicitly talking about here even, not just about legal information, but in general, that how people use information is going to be affected by what in my research I call legal capability. That's to say, things like literacy, their analytical skills, their whether they have mental health problems, whether they have stress and other health problems. A whole range of things are going to impact how people use information and how they digest it. It's true that thumbs up people can interpret really simply, but any kind of more nuanced use of information, which is typically the context in legal information, and particularly how people solve legal problems, is a much more nuanced kind of issue, and capability makes a difference. Likewise, complexity of problems. The more complex the problems are, the more difficult, or the guess is that information is both going to be a help and a hindrance. People can, for example, see to their pants, solve problems if it involves making one phone call to an obvious. It's a much more complex thing if it requires a complex navigation. And those kind of questions. So that's just sort of the kind of work I do, and I was told to talk about it. So that's more or less what I'm saying.
Thank you, Alex. So the floor is yours. Marina,
first. I have a couple of questions for Les.
Sure.
So I just want to know, when is the 2014 legal, everyday legal life problems going to come out? Because the website has been given snippets, and I really want to have the whole study. So that's the first thing. The second thing is Mary Cavanaugh and I just received funding from the Law Foundation of Ontario to do a study on legal information seeking practices on consumer problems in telecommunications. And I think your work is great for us because it gives us the background, but it's not granular enough. And I think you found that in your research as well, the different kinds of consumer problems writ large are very different from consumer problems if I have a faulty dishwasher, from if I have a problem with my mobile phone or my furnace is not working. So anyway, we need to talk, but I really want to know, and then that study on legal information that you're doing longitudinally, so it's not going to come out before 2018, 19, I'm just wondering.
It's true that there's snippets that have been coming out of that. We actually have a summary of the broad findings that is, if you email me, I can email. They're one of the more interesting questions is making the database available to people. And another hat I wear is I am the director of the Institute for Social Research, which is the biggest university-based survey research center in the country. And we actually, even though the research project with MIND, the institute that I direct actually did the data collection. And we have terrific data. And one of the features of that data that we did, which no other countries have done some of these legal needs things, but actually I designed it so that there's a possibility of qualitative research. So, for example, about 800 people in the study with consumer problems agreed that we could do follow-up qualitative research, which I've actually, I've done a bit of, but to be honest, I actually just haven't had enough time. Let me spit out your the legal information. It's not per se about consumer problems. It's funded by the Law Foundation of Ontario. It's in fact their biggest grant they've ever given for a research project. And but family, family housing. We've just added human rights discrimination. The interesting thing, and we're doing it in Ontario and BC. And it, but the interesting thing is that when I give talks like this, these organizations, other people with other interests will say, we'd like to do that. And that's actually what's been, we're going to add another one of the social justice tribunals because they're keen on, so it's actually, it's a project that can be expanded to other areas. Part of it is just around funding and time.
So I'm Mary Cavanaugh from the University of Ottawa, and I'm from not from law, I'm from the information side of the world. And so I'm interested, just maybe it's obvious, but it's one of those simple questions, what is legal information? We have many categorization problems. What is consumer information, and how do we contain it and organize it? My business is organizing information and making it available and understanding how people access it in a multitude of ways. So, and I come from the background of public libraries. I know what I think legal information is, but I don't know what you think it is, and I don't know what most of all consumers think it is, and I think that that's something that certainly we'll be working on, and I don't know if you have a frame for that, or?
I mean, the short answer is we do have a frame, but the frame is set up in a relatively conventional
law.
Legal services model.
Yeah. It's not big enough.
Yeah, and that's a perfectly valid point.
We're just going to keep going down the line.
I'm thinking for you. Les, really interesting work. You may remember this morning I was saying how the work that Lucas and I are doing is basically just comparing legal instruments and, if you want to call them extra legal instruments, in a number of different regimes in four different jurisdictions, but it was not really getting at which is the better system in terms of protecting consumers. That seems to be a much more challenging question to get at. But I'm just wondering whether or not the survey that you're doing, if there's a comparable survey being done concerning other jurisdictions, because that would be helpful in revealing, you know, for example, is that 9% figure that you came up with Canada, is that comparable to the figure in the U.S. or completely unacceptable in the U.S. and U.K. and Australia? So if you're not doing that sort of thing, then may I make a plea for you to get together with, you know, your sort of colleagues in other jurisdictions so that you get that cross-jurisdictional justice, access to justice information, because I think it would be fabulously useful to have the cross-jurisdictional stuff.
Very similar. When Matt and David were talking about the scenarios, yeah. One of the methodological decisions was rather than to ask people about, in general, consumer problems, our study specifically gave scenarios because other international studies scenarios. On, a couple of years, 2010, the Legal Aid Ontario did a very interesting study called the Civil Legal Needs Study, and they actually just asked people, do you have a legal problem? what have been important legal problems. The interesting thing is that in that study, about 50% of the problems reported were family problems. And consumer problems were, I think, about 1.5%. I just gave a talk at the Law Society of Upper Canada last week about that. And the difference in which methodology plays is huge in those kind of differences, right? So that goes to the question about not just about what legal information is, but actually what is a legal problem.
Consumers' access to justice. And what I'm looking at in this paper is access to consumer justice. And how is that concept defined? Because I've been hearing this thread all day, this notion of justice. And justice is one thing, but consumer justice is another thing. And I'm trying to link it to the notion of consumer rights and human rights. And if you have blah, 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 blah. So if anyone's remotely interested, just give me a shout and we can play with the idea. But I've just been hearing this thread. It's a cool thread that's been running through her all day long.
Just to do a plug for Les's book, actually. There's a bit of an unpacking of that conceptual framework and the relation between those two in the privacy rights book. So you might be interested in that.
You know, we find in our data that sometimes consumers have to be protected against themselves. I mean, they're not always in the right, and I'll give you some examples. We have lots of information about home renovation and how important it is to get 3 quotes and to get receipts and to check and make sure that the firm that you're dealing with is licensed, talk to their previous customers, and yet we still find each year thousands of consumers who pay cash in order to save money. They have no receipts. They get taken to the cleaners. They don't know the name of the company, but the guy promised to come back the next day. They're out $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 because they thought they were going to save some money. And, you know, there's probably 15 home reno shows on television that tell you what to do. And there's gobs of information on our website, and yet still people want to engage in the underground economy to save money, in quotes, which of course ends up being much more expensive.
Thank you, David. Yeah, no, I think that's a really nice illustration that the information may not hook, right?
I want to move a little bit to the topics that we're talking about in the two panels, and that it connects. It's just this idea is, how do we go about doing the research to answer the questions that, right, the sharing economy raises or that the social media raises? And listening to the presentations on the collaborative economy, it all seems so good for the consumer, right? Consumers love Uber. I've never used it. I think I always felt sort of guilty. Either way. But that's a big question that I have, because we can do all sorts of measurements, customer satisfaction, but the consumers, in a way, it goes back to just what David was saying. They're saying, oh, this is a good service and it's cheaper than. But, you know, as a consumer, you're not necessarily thinking of the big picture. So how do we get away from the individual, this is working out for me, to is this working out for, what are all of the spillover effects? And how can we do research that captures that? Because we'll do research on the legal side, on the business side, on the economic side. But who's looking at all of these different perspectives? Maybe it's impossible. These partnerships are supposed to allow us to do interdisciplinary work. But we know how challenging that is. But how do we get out there and actually try to evaluate what these things mean from more than one perspective.
No, I'm going to try to provide a policy answer, which relates somewhat to Alexander's work. You know, usually what happens with international legislation that comes down the pipe is somebody co-opts it. They see it coming. They see their financial interests. They frame it up. They propose some things, and that's what you get. But right now we've got some a preemptive strike that's maybe a lot more genial. And this is the proposed joint action by Consumers International and the International Association of Computer Programmers and so on. I can remember their exact title. But this is to try to write a framework which would be one of these types of agreements on what's fair practice in international commerce. Internet commerce. So they're trying to devise the rules, you know, that would make internet commerce more fair to everybody before somebody else writes them up in such a way that they're fair to, you know, maybe big drug companies or somebody like that. So it's actually an opportunity. And I mention it here today on purpose because we've got four members of the coalition that we represent, the initiative, who belong to Consumers International. And so the ability to work with that group is higher than you would normally expect. And I heard a lot of things today, Alexander, you're mentioning some dangers and that sort of thing, that have been at least recognized as risks and so on. And those kinds of things could be brought together. So what we'd like to do is participate, or at least have our four active members participate with Consumers International and try to get some sort of a fair framework. So that's what I want to say. Thanks.
Thank you, Barbara. Do you have other comment or questions about the two last sessions? Oh, my two provocative questions? My first one was more in the continuity of discussion we have about the right to be forgotten. Because in so many ways, as I mentioned, I wonder if the law is a good tool to regulate this kind of problems. But we already have some discussion, and I think your answer was quite right. For sure, law in some cases could be very useful, but in some other way, we need to be more creative in the way to apply some legal tools. And that's why I was happy to react to the comment of Kernighan that the standard could be, I don't want to say it's a panacea, it's a wonderful tool to survive in the economy, but I think it's an option that could be very useful for his academic and people from the business too, to be creative in new form to apply some law. But maybe I want to come back to my second one because we already have some discussion on that. But I saw the book of Les, but I don't sure the title, but it's Privacy Rights in the Global Context or something like this. It was the book of last year in 2014. Yeah. And I saw the five titles of your book. And you have the middle social media and aggression, danger of... In each of your titles, you have the name of aggression, danger, and need to be careful, etc., etc. I think it's true, there is new dangers, but... In some other way, and I love to use the sentences of a French philosopher, Michel Serres, which is quite optimistic about new technology. And he mentioned that, we lost something, and in some ways there is some danger, but in a whole way there is some new way to be more transparent and to be more aware of the danger we find. And Alexandre, you mentioned Dana Boyle. We say that the young people, in fact, have some privacy. For them, it's very important to respect privacy, but it's a new form of privacy, and they use new technology to protect them, the privacy. She gave the example of the two young girls, two teens who, after a show with their parents, decide to tweet their own comment to be sure that the parents don't listen to them. So they use the new technology to protect themselves. So I just want to leave you react of this danger that new technology present, and in some cases the new opportunity that they may propose to, particularly to the new generations. For you and the whole audience, for sure.
There's a chapter in the book on about a study I did of 18 to 24-year-olds of how I asked them a series of questions, open-ended questions, about how they understood privacy, how they understood privacy rights, and asked them, in effect, about what experiences they'd had with privacy violations on, they're all Facebook users, every single one of them, right? So it was pretty easy to kind of find a common social networking experience. And their paths, sort of what they did about it. And the striking thing from a legal point of view is they actually all understood privacy in a way that's relatively commensurate to existing legislation. So they saw it in terms of personal information, which again, for people who have any kind of history of privacy, right, a lot of people in this room know that 40 years ago, privacy was closely tied to things like sexual reproduction and all this sort of, and that sort of has fallen off the, completely off the radar, right? That instead it's all about personal information. And they also saw it as a quasi-constitutional right in a Canadian context, right? So they actually thought that they had a right to privacy. They had an understanding of privacy that was relatively mapped onto how the legal profession understands privacy. But when it came to what they did about privacy violations, the striking thing is, even though they saw it as a public law right, they overwhelmingly turned to private justice solutions. So the overwhelming first two choices were either what I call self-regulation. So they say, oh, yeah, you know, I left my phone on my bed in the residence and somebody came in and screwed around on my Facebook page. I put a password on my phone, right? So kind of a self-regulation kind of solution. Or the private justice solution, they would turn to Facebook to complain. They would see themselves as clients and having a bad customer experience, and they complained. But which is bizarre, right? In a broader context, that other kinds of public rights, if you want quasi-constitutional rights, they might have to kind of turned into a private law issue is unusual, right? So there are these kind of aspects. I don't agree with David that if they don't care about privacy. I think that though their understandings about what they do with it and their sort of what I call paths to justice that they take are actually, there really are quite different generational solutions, which, you know, is, I don't know if that actually, doesn't mean that I don't think that I'm a pretty big fan of the digital economy. I just think that on the other hand, that it's not all positive, right? I mean,
I just want to qualify. It's not that they don't care. It's that they don't think that contacting the government does anything, which I
almost
think is,
nobody in this study thought they just, even knew about the Privacy Commission. You know, I mean, part of the study was funded by the Privacy Commission of Canada, and I would ask them questions about whether they would know anything about
it. Yeah, I mean, I have two sons who are in their 20s, and I've worked for the government for 18 years, and they've never asked me once what I do.
What do they
So I think it's time for closing this free discussion. So thank you for your attention, and I think we have a break. Thank you. No break.